is Dr. Mark Hamel, who is the Director of Psychosocial Oncology for the McGill University Health Center. He's worked as a psychologist in palliative care for many, many years and has done research on family meetings, which is going to be the topic of his discussion. So he's the perfect person to talk to us about that. So without further ado, Mark Hamel.
Great. Well, I like, before I start, I just recovered from a horrible cold. Those who know me know that I have a raspy voice, but this is even worse today. So I'm really glad this is taped. So hopefully you'll be able to understand. If you don't, just let me know. And hopefully my voice will hold up till the end of my presentation. So as I was said, I'm a clinical psychologist. I've been the clinical director in psychosocial oncology since its opening, so the last 3 years. Prior to that, I was working in palliative care. I'm still involved, but not as much. So I was asked today to talk to you about family meetings because that's my research and clinical interest. So hopefully I will be able to bring you some clinical experience that I've acquired with the team on family meetings. I'll reserve 10-15 minutes for questions at the end if that's okay. So I'm sure all of you understand that cancer is not just a patient affair, it's a family illness. So cancer causes a ripple effect across all the family members and elicits fears, uncertainty, disruption in family functioning and routine, and changes in interpersonal dynamics. As a patient of mine once told me, once we got the diagnosis, and he said we, so it was not just him but the family, nothing is ever the same after that. And we need to understand, so when the patients have been through treatments, they've been through the tests, the scans and all that, they come with a history. So when they're referred to the palliative care unit or referred to the palliative care services on a consultation basis, they come with a history. So there's a history of interpersonal dynamics. So families come with conflicts, they come with relationships with their parents, with their children, their spouses, so they come with a dynamic, an interpersonal dynamic. Another history they come with is in terms of their treatments. So they've been through chemotherapy sometimes, radiotherapy, treatment, scans, blood work. So they've always been taken care of, so to speak, by a medical team. And now they're referred to palliative care, and oftentimes they feel abandoned. But there's a history, and it's important to remember this. Finally, there's another history of the cancer in the family. So it's rare that people have not been touched by cancer previous to their own experience with cancer. And that experience, good or bad, will affect how they will cope with their current situation. So this history, or histories as I like to call it, can impact how the patient and the family members will cope during end-of-life care. So some of the reactions that we often see, and I'm sure this is not new to all of you, the many reactions can include sadness and depression. I think Dr. Looper will talk about depression after me. Denial and disbelief, anger, feelings of helplessness, feelings of panic and anxiety. And all of this, what I'm trying to convey here, is oftentimes bottled up until they get to the palliative care phase. So they've been through the treatments, they've been feeling that they've been taken care of, they're referred or they're transferred to the palliative care unit, or they're asked the consult team to come in and see the patients, and all of this can explode because the families are now vulnerable. So caring for the patient is also addressing the needs of the family of the patient. So what I'm going to talk to you about today is how we can intervene and help the patient in helping the families, and one of the interventions that we often use is family meetings. In the literature, you'll also look, you'll find family conferences, and they're often used interchangeably. So why do we conduct family meetings? So the first thing is, if we look at a study in 2006 that looked at what matters most for patients and family members at the end of life. And this was a study on 434 patients. And what they found, the top five were the following. These are for the patients. The first one, what matters most at the end of life, is to have trust and confidence in their doctors. The second most important thing for the patients was not to be kept alive on life support. Third, that information about the disease be communicated to them by the doctor in an honest manner. And the fourth one, is to complete things and prepare for life's end. So life reviews, resolving conflicts, and saying goodbye. And I think this last thing that matters to them is where we can intervene as well. A second reason why we should conduct conduct family meetings is because families report high levels of emotional distress. I've been working in the Canadian Partnership Against Cancer Standards and Guidelines in terms of psychosocial oncology care, and emotional distress is now recognized as a sixth vital sign, alongside with temperature, vital signs and all of those. I was telling someone that since recovering from my cold, it's like my brain is here and my thoughts are there. They don't always run together. So the sixth vital sign is an important aspect of things that we need to assess. And we often talk about patient distress, which tends to be between 35 to 45%. But we rarely talk about family distress. And those of us who work in palliative care know that that is as important to deal with than the patient's distress. And the few studies that exist, in Zwollen, for instance, in 2008, looked at emotional distress in family members. And they reported that 29.2% of family members who are taking care of someone of oncology patients reported moderate levels of distress. And 18% report high levels of emotional distress. In our clinic, in our psychosocial oncology clinic, what's interesting in our data, we see patients at all stages of the disease, as well as family members. And consistently, in terms of the data, the family members report higher levels of depression, higher levels of anxiety, and higher levels of emotional distress. Now, you may say it's a biased sample because they're referred to psychosocial services, but when you compare them with the patients, the families are struggling a lot more, or at least reporting it so. So family distress is an important aspect of end-of-life care. Excuse me. Another reason, and this is reported in literature consistently, is family meetings help to facilitate communication between the physician, the treating team, and the patient and the family members. And Azuli said this very well, that the cornerstone of family-centered care is early, effective, intensive communication with the patient's relatives. We cannot do patient-centered care without taking care or dealing with family issues and speaking with family relatives. So in terms of communication, the family meetings help to answer and respond to the needs of the family members, enabling them to understand what's going on and to reduce their anxiety and depression. A fourth reason, and this is the crust of my presentation, is dealing with family conflicts. I'm often called upon, in terms of consultation, to go up on floors and deal with a conflict in the family. So the spouse is angry at the doctors for not doing more blood work or doing the vital signs. The daughter of a patient wants to push the patient to go at home when visibly that is not safe for the patient. So a lot of family conflicts is something that we need to address also in palliative care. And in terms of the literature, in 2006, there was a retrospective study with families of elders with advanced care. And what they found was 55% of those deaths had family conflicts during that time. Breen and Allen, 2001, also examined conflicts in 102 patients where in ICU settings where discussion of withdrawal or withholding of treatment was considered. What is interesting is that 48% there was conflict between the staff and the family members. So half of those discussions, there was conflict. There's also conflict among the staff members themselves about whether we should withhold treatment or not. And among the family members, it was about 24%. So conflict exists. We cannot ignore its presence. And ignoring it does not help to address it. Another study by Kissane and Al in 2006 suggested that family conflict in palliative care settings is quite frequent. And they say about 71% of the families that they saw presented either with a family with intermediate conflicts or they were really dysfunctional. And I'm sure those of you who work in palliative care settings are very aware of family conflicts. So what are the common causes of conflicts in palliative care in terms of families and patients? And this is a recent study and report, and the first source of conflict is information. And let's think about this. The first one is poor, inaccurate understanding of the medical condition. So families, the source of the conflict is oftentimes that they're overly optimistic, right, about the prognosis, about advanced directives, for instance. Another source of conflict in terms of information is inconsistent information, and we've all lived this. So one physician tells the family member or the patient one thing, another physician tells something else. So this inconsistent message causes a lot of conflict. And, for instance, we hear patients say, well, I was told that if I get stronger, I will get chemo. If I get stronger, I will get more treatments. So just that message, and they're on a palliative care unit where chemo is visibly out of the question, can cause conflict. Yeah, but I was told that if you get stronger, you'll get more treatments. So that's another source of potential conflict. Confusing information. So we often speak to family members and patients, and we use language and that we, to us, is everyday use, but to them could be misconstrued as something else. So our jargon can sometimes elicit feelings of anxiety and uncertainty and lead to conflict. Excessive information. Sometimes I've been in family meetings where the physician started to explain the medical status, and you could see the family members just looking out into the horizon and being completely lost with information. So sometimes if we ourselves are very anxious about delivering bad news or delivering poor prognosis, we can overwhelm family members with so much information, and that can cause later on conflict. Genuine uncertainty. So not knowing exactly what the prognosis is going to be like can cause family members to become conflictual. Language, translation, cultural issues can also lead to conflict. If I've done, for instance, a family meeting with cultural minority, and we had a translator to come in because we didn't speak the language, and so we asked the translator to talk about what's the family's understanding of how long the patient has, and the translator became very silent. So then we looked at her and said, can you translate? And she became very emotional and said, we don't say that in our culture. We don't speak about the word death. So we have to be sensitive also to cultural issues in terms of end-of-life care. Other sources of conflict is within the family themselves, between the family and the team, and also within the team themselves. And this can propel families into crises. So the conflict within the family or between family and patient, dysfunctional family systems, as I said, patients and families come with histories of relationships between them. And sometimes a family member can have difficulty to put their own needs above that of the patient. Disagreement among the team members, and this we sometimes experience this in our teams. So there's an inconsistent message. Why should we give palliative chemo? We should help the patient and the family to prepare for end-of-life care. And this is a debate right now in many settings. Sedation. So some people in the team may not agree that this is the right time for sedation, and others, yes. So if we as a team cannot present a consistent message and a united front, how are we to expect that the family members themselves can be comfortable with a decision that the team presents? Lack of trust in healthcare systems, and that we often see that. And that's why the history of the family members and the patients with their previous treating experience is really important. If there's mistrust, there's a reason. There's been an incident. There's been something that occurred previously. And we need to understand that. It may have nothing to do with the care that you're providing right now. It may have nothing to do with your skills, the way you're delivering care. It may have to do with what's happened before. So the specific goals of family meetings are the following, is to provide accurate information about the patient's medical status, medical condition. And when I say accurate as much as we are able to provide. Assess the patient and family member's needs. So in addition to taking care of the loved one, what is the needs of the family members themselves? And I'll get into that a little bit more. Address conflictual situations. Goals of care, I'm here to say, goals of care is not just patient care, but it's beyond that. It's also family care. Patients tell me that all the time when I see them. Is there anything I can do for you? Help so-and-so, help my daughter, help my grandchildren, help my spouse to deal with this. I rarely have difficulty issues with my patients. It's mostly the family members who have a difficult time accepting what's going on. Understand the wishes about end-of-life care and their views. To understand the pragmatics of advanced directives. Discuss discharge planning. That's one of the goals of family meetings. And assess family coping and identify those who are at risk. We do a lot of bereavement work as psychologists on the floor and in the psychosocial oncology program. And I can assure you that assessing those family members who are at risk for bereavement difficulties, this is a key intervention. We prevent a lot of bereavement complications by addressing them earlier. Goals of care also include site of care and options and care planning. So how effective are family meetings? Yeah, so Mark, you're talking about family meetings, but are they effective? Unfortunately, there's not a lot of studies out there, but those that exist do suggest that they are helpful. And one of the studies by Hudson looked at 20 family meetings in palliative care setting, and what they found was that it reduced the family members' worry. It helped them to move towards an acceptable solution in terms of treatment plan and increase the family members' confidence in dealing with day-to-day problems as a result of the meeting. Another study in 2004 looked at in an ICU setting and they audiotaped the family conferences. And what they found, what family members during the family conference that were given, let me just backtrack, their results indicated that on the audio taped, 29% of the time the family member spoke, 71% of the time it was mental health professionals. So we speak a lot more. What's interesting in the study is that the family opportunity to talk increased their satisfaction with the physician's communication. It also increased the proportion of family speech was also associated with decreased family ratings of conflict with the physician. So what does this say? What does this tell us? It tells us if we allow the family members to talk about what they're going through, they will feel that you're a much better communicator, and they will feel that there is less conflict, even though there may be one. So that's a very important home message for us. So let me walk you through, I'm doing pretty good in time, on how we conduct a family meeting on a palliative care unit. So before the meeting, this is key, let me stress this plus, you need to prepare the family and the patient. Do not just go, oh, we're going to plan a family meeting next Tuesday, can you be there at 3? What do you think they leave with? Oh my God, what's going on? Oh my God, is he going to die? What's going to happen? What are they going to tell us? They panic. So you need to prepare them why you're presenting a family meeting, why you want one in the first place. So the families need to be prepared and the patient as well. Offer different choices in terms of the times. Try to be as flexible as you can. Patients and families have so little sense of control. Giving them just that little sense of when would be the best time for you and your family to come and meet with us is very, very powerful for them. Ask family members and the patient if they have worries or concerns about the family meeting. Are there things that you wish for us to address? And explain why you want the family meeting. We want a family meeting. What we generally say is we'd like to meet you and everyone that's important to you and your family. So that gives them an opportunity to ask the team questions. And it gives us an opportunity to get to know all of you and see how you're doing. And if there's not anything else that we can do to make things easier for you and your family members. And when it's presented that way, I've never seen anyone refuse. If you want to take this down, there's a very nice patient information sheet that was produced by a moneymaker in Journal of Palliative Medicine. And it's a nice patient information sheet. So it explains and introduces what a family conference is like, what the goals are, who can participate. So it explains very well who they should invite and how they can, the family and the patient can prepare themselves for the meeting. I tried to produce this, but it didn't work on my computer. But it's a one-page sheet, and it's very, very helpful. So all that to say is that family members and patients need to be prepared ahead of time. For the health professionals, this is also very important. Before the meeting, and this is what I started to install, appliqué on the unit, is the team who's going to be present at the meeting need to meet also beforehand. So meeting to determine what are the goals of the meeting. Is it to resolve a conflict? Is it to discuss transfer to a hospice? Is it to discuss pain control? So what's the goal of the family meeting? So evolution, prognosis, plan of care, conflicts, etc. Determine if any worries for the team regarding the meeting. For instance, if a physician has been very involved and there's a counter-transference issues or they're feeling very, very sad, or so they may need a colleague to join them in the family meeting. So try to determine if there are any concerns or worries that we need to address before going in. Who will chair or run the family meeting is really important. It's not always that has to be a physician. It could be a psychologist that's been involved. It could be a nurse, clinical nurse specialist. It could be anyone in the team that has had a good contact with the family and patient. Finally, and this we often fight, who will write the summary in the patient's chart? This needs to be determined ahead of time. It makes things a lot easier. So what are the modular blueprint for conducting a family meeting? So once you've done the, you've asked for a family meeting and you've agreed on a time, you agreed who is going to be there, now is the family meeting. So you welcome and orient to the goals of the family meeting. So whoever chairs the meeting says, well, thank you all for coming after the introductions, introduce the team, introduce the family members, and to explain why we all here together. So you thank them for coming. And we're here because we wanted to meet with all of you, and we wanted to discuss where things are at with your father, or with your mother, or whoever the patient is. Always check ahead of time what's the family's, or the family, when I say the family, it's everyone as a unit, what's their understanding of the patient's status. Do not assume that everybody has the same information. Do not assume that everybody understands well the same information. And do not assume that the patient and the family all agree on that information. So if the patient is present, you may ask, well, Mr. So-and-so, you've been on our unit for a week. So how are things going? What's your understanding of where things are at? Okay. 10 minutes. So you get the family or the patient to talk about where they feel they're at. Check for consensus about the current goals of care. So what's the plan? What have people have thought about in terms of where do we go from here? And you'll get a good sense of where the family and the patient are at in terms of prognosis. Have they discussed the issue of the possibility of their dad dying? Has that been addressed at all or not? Identify family concerns about their management of key symptoms or care needs. So what are the most difficult part in your dad being in the hospital, either palliative care setting or on consult on another floor or even at home if this is your area? Clarify with the family what their view of the future holds. Clarify how the family members are coping and feeling emotionally. Remember the last study I talked about before? Give the family members an opportunity to talk about how they're coping. And you'd be surprised that someone that's been cared for cancer for many, many years, family members would tell me, I've never been asked how I'm doing. I've never been asked how I'm coping. Ever. So this is an opportunity for them. Identify the family's strengths and affirm their level of commitment and mutual support of each other. So sometimes we need to be there and bring everyone together and to praise the family of how well they're doing with a difficult situation. And that, again, is something that we rarely tell family members. You know what? Given the situation, you guys have handled this very, very well. And you should be happy and proud of yourself for doing that. After the meeting. So the team often benefits from a debriefing session, is what I call it. And so take 10 minutes as a group to discuss, so what's your impression of how it went? Were the goals achieved that you discussed before? So if there was a conflict that you wanted to address, was that addressed? Did it change anything? Have a consensus on the results. So was it positive, neutral, or negative? If there's going to be a follow-up, so if they say we will follow, if there's a family that's having difficulty coping and you refer to either the social worker or pastoral care or can support or psychosocial oncology, so who will do the follow-up? Verify with the family and the patient their feelings and impressions of the meeting. This is rarely talked about, but when I was doing family meetings, I would always go back a day or two. How did it go for you? What was that like for you? Is there any remaining concerns or issues that resulted after the meeting? And I think that's really, really important to follow up. We completed a study on family meetings. We had, I think it was around 40, 50 family meetings. And unfortunately, I was too sick to do the stats. But hopefully I'll be able to present it sometime. So documenting the family conference. As I said, during the pre-meeting on the team, we discussed who's going to document. And this is really, really important. So in terms of documentation, this is the information in terms of standards and guidelines that should be in the chart. It's the following information. Who was present at the family meeting? If the patient was not present, why was not he or she present? List the family members, the relationship with the patient, age and gender. What was the goal of the family meeting? So what was the agenda? What are the themes that were discussed? Goals of care, discharge planning, dealing with family conflict. What was the outcome of that, depending on what the goal of the meeting was? What's the follow-up plan? So if there's was a referral, for instance, to hospice or referral to joint services, who's going to follow through? And if the patient was not there, I'm sure some of you will ask, should the patient be there or not? It depends. If the patient was not there, the outcome of the family meeting should be shared with him or her, of course, if they're able to understand the information. Which brings me to the following issue in terms of consent. So many times we conduct family meetings and we don't think about if the patient, for instance, we need to ask the patient for their permission to have a family meeting. And this study in 2004 looked at that, and what they found in terms of rehabilitation settings, 22 patient interviews, that only 37.5% of the patients reported that they had not been informed of a family meeting. 75% of patients reported that they had not been asked who they would like to be present. It's kind of mind-boggling when you think of it. And 28% of family meetings notes were documented in terms of verbal consent. So it needs to be in the patient's chart that consent was asked for the patient. Sometimes, you know, oh, we'd love to have a family meeting, but we don't want the patient to be there. So what do you do with that? Well, you need to ask why. So what's the concern if the patient is there? So let me go through clinical cases because I have 5 minutes. So these are family meetings. I've changed information for confidentiality, but it doesn't change the gist of the information. So there's a young man, and his, let's say, late 40s, and his wife were struggling with what to say to their children. This happened. This case is very, very common. And the young man was losing his battle with cancer. He would not be able to return home, as he had promised his kids. The thing was, he told the children, "I'm going to the hospital, get treatment, and I'll be back." The case is that the disease progressed very rapidly, and there was no way for him to come home. So these parents could not find the strength to speak to their children, and have been following the patient on the ward. And he asked me, "Can you help me? Because I don't know what to do." So the intervention, we had a family meeting. So the intervention consisted of the physician and the psychologist. I always like to have a physician there or a nurse who can answer medical questions, because family members trust me, and especially with children, it's easier to talk about medical stuff than to talk about emotions. So there was a physician. I was there. Both parents were present, as well as the three children, age 11, 13, and 17. Because I knew this couple so well, I was the one chairing the family meeting. And I said, "Thank you all for coming in. We had the chance to meet with your mom and your dad. And we want to get to know you and to answer any questions that you may have about what's going on with dad. We will try to answer your questions as best as we can. So how about we start by asking you to tell us what you think is going on right now." So we asked, "Do you have any questions about what's going on? Do you have any worries or concerns?" So once the kids began to ask questions, and they were very curious about, "So dad's been here for a couple of weeks, what's going on?" So we explained it to the level that the children could understand, meaning that your dad is very, very, very sick. We've done everything that we can to try to make him better. Unfortunately, it's not what we had hoped for, and things are getting worse. So that was pretty clear, pretty easy for them to understand what we were saying. And once we started to get the conversation going, the father took over, and he informed his kids that the doctors had done everything and that they were now trying to keep him comfortable. He continued telling the children that he would soon die, and that he loved them and he was proud of them. So the family meeting really helped this family, this couple, to start the conversation. And once the conversation was ongoing, we said, "We will leave you as a family and we'll come back later." So that was a very powerful intervention in terms of this couple. How am I doing for time? Do I have one more? One more? Okay. Another family meeting was offered, so this is a little less, was a more difficult one, was two sisters who were at war, who were both very, very devoted to their mother, very caring for her, but they could not stand the sight of each other. I mean, this was like every time both of them would be in the hospital, you would feel the tension. So, And it was impeding really on the patient care, because one sister wanted one thing, the other sister wanted something else. So we decided to have a family meeting, and the patient status was actually quite unpredictable. And the patient was not present during this family meeting because she did not want to be present. She said, "Deal with the two my two daughters." So the two daughters were there. I was there. The physician of the patient was there, as well as the nurse manager. And let me tell you, it was a very difficult family meeting, because as soon as they sat down together, one, I was here, one sister was there, the other one was there, they just started yelling and screaming. And so in this case, I had to become very, very like a parental figure, and I had to say, well, we need to stop here, stop screaming at each other, this is not getting us anywhere. And if you continue to raise your voice, we're going to stop the family meeting. So sometimes the family members need to be reminded that, and actually that's what I said. I said, you know, I know you disagree. I don't know what the source of the disagreement is. But frankly, there will be lots of time for you to deal with this after your mom's gone. And can we focus on what's best for her right now? And what's best for her is for you to take good care of her. And we all want the same thing. You want the same thing. You do. You want the same thing for your mom. So can we agree on that? Sometimes, as in this case, the suffering of the family is so great and that they really can't overcome their emotions and their anger. So sometimes we had to set up schedules. So you can come between such time and such time, you can come between this time and that time. Because when we think about, again, our priorities for the patient, because this was causing a lot of distress for the mother, having the daughters fight with each other. And the fantasy in the patient is that the team is not going to like me because of my daughters. So we need to make sure that the patient is reassured. So sometimes we need to create separating visiting hours, and because we have to take care also of the other patients and families on the floor, right? If one family is screaming and yelling, it affects the others. So we have to sometimes apply the zero tolerance law. So let me just go very quickly. So what are the lessons learned? I hope you can take away from the presentation. Family meetings and conferences are useful for family members and patients. I'm often asked, should we do family conference? If you ask the question, the answer is always yes. I've never, ever, ever had a family conference that was not productive, was not useful. So it's not just for families who are screaming and yelling at each other. And we often assume that everybody, oh, they're fine, they're okay, the family members are on board. Don't always assume that's the case. Family conferences facilitate communication between the physician and the patient and the family members. It also allows for us to be able to normalize the family's reactions, especially those who are having a hard time dealing with what's going on. When conducting family meetings, encourage members to speak, to talk about what's going on, how they're feeling. Do not assume that all family members have the same information. Provide positive feedback on how they're coping. And even the most difficult families, they're really doing the best that they can. And if you keep that as a perspective, because sometimes we tend to label, oh, they're a difficult family, they're the angry family. And already if we have that perception, it affects, whether you want to or not, our interactions with them. So I always try to go with the idea that, you know, they're having a hard time. Yes, they are difficult, but they're really doing the best that they can at the moment. I always say this in terms of, especially when there's a young person with cancer and they have young children, or the grandparent is dying, always ask how the kids are doing, especially men who are not very expressive in terms of their emotions. If you ask them how are the kids doing, they will start talking about not only their kids but also about themselves. So it's a good opportunity to intervene in that sense. Be free of judgment. Sometimes it's our own agenda that's into play, when especially if there's conflict between the teams about the goal of care. So we need to address that before we project it on the family. And always foster hope, of course. In the absence of a cure, there's always different hopes to achieve, and families need to understand that. Oftentimes when they refer to palliative care, they say, well, there's nothing we can do now, and that's it. There's always something we can do, and families need to hear that, even in the palliative care phase of their illness. So how about questions? My voice made it. So any questions? Yes. Yes. She was asking, do we need the patient's consent to meet when they're not present? Yes. Unless the patient is not cognitively able to give their consent, always ask for a consent. Because think about it, if you're a patient yourself and there's a meeting and you don't know about it, how would you feel? And we can't treat patients who are ill as if they're not there. So always ask for consent. If it's rare that they'll say no. And if they say no, it's an opportunity for you to understand why. So what's going on there? What are their concerns? What are their worries? But consent is a really, really important issue.
Do you feel the family meeting is the appropriate forum to address when a family member has expressed intent to commit suicide?
The family member?
Mm-hmm.
Who said this to a health professional?
Health professional.
No.
No. How would you best, how do you think that should be dealt with?
Are you talking about that? No? Okay. For instance, if someone mentions that once he goes, I'm going to go with him or I'm going to go afterwards, if there's a suicidal intention or wish or expression of such a wish, it always needs to be evaluated and assessed further. So what do you mean by that? I would not do that in a family setting. If it expressed in the family conference setting, I would take that person aside afterwards. But I would assess further what that wish about. Is it just a wish, or is it really more than that? So it needs to be assessed. So is there a previous history? Is there a history of depression or a major depressive episode going on? But does that answer your question? Okay, who's the patient here?
There is a patient, okay, and his spouse is expressing intent to commit suicide.
Okay, and it's your response?
She refuses, oh, I see what you're saying. She refuses to see a health professional.
Then if...
Without her husband present.
That's okay. So, you want me to talk lower? Or her? Did everybody hear the question? So if a person expresses suicidal intent, it's our responsibility to assess it further. If she doesn't want to see a health professional and we are concerned about that patient, we have a responsibility to have her evaluated. And at times that needs to bring her down to emergency, whether she wants to or not, because we have a responsibility, right? Confidentiality stops if there's a menace, a threat to her life. That's a good question. When I document with a family member, I always ask the family member the permission to chart it in the patient's chart because they don't, technically they're not our patient. But I would say I'm going to document this unless you tell me otherwise. I'm going to document this in patient's, in your husband's chart. But in terms of suicidal ideations, confidentiality does no longer apply in terms of their safety. But we really need to understand what is she expressing? Because oftentimes we hear, once he goes, I don't know, I'm going to live with it, I'm going to kill myself. But is that just a wish, or is that really the actual intent? Does that answer your question? Yes. Legally, I don't think we are allowed to have a family conference without the patient's consent. So we need to address with the patient. First of all, if there's a family meeting, we would address it with the patient, right? We would like to have a family meeting with your family, those that you consider important, and who would those people be? Who would you like to welcome? If the patient says no, then you can't have a family meeting. Without the patient?
But they say,
then I would explore why is it that you do not want him or her there? What are your concerns? But we cannot have a family meeting without the patient's consent. Like I said, if you were a patient and it was a family meeting without your awareness, it would break the trust, right?
There's a lot of informal meetings that happen, sometimes one family member, two family members who just want more information and whatnot.
That's different.
So that would be different. You don't need the consent from the patient at that point, though it's probably best to inform the patient that the family's been wanting more information.
Yeah.
Okay. Because sometimes it's not so formalized and...
But the family meeting, in terms of setting everybody a time for everybody, is pretty formal. It's a pretty formal intervention.
Sometimes there's spontaneous family meetings.
I guess what I'm saying is that I've seen situations where there were family meetings and the patient didn't know about it, and the impact it has on the patient can be it can break a lot of trust. And I'm very, very anal about those things. So I always like to be very clean. Do we have time for one more? No? One more? No way?
Probably just a small comment. I think the way to distinguish between an informal meeting and a family meeting is, you know, the place to make major decision about care of the patient should be within the family meetings. You can meet families to explore, to understand the situation, but you should not have a decision made about patient care without the consent of the patients. I think this is the way to try to separate the two.
And that's a good point. For instance, if you're going to have a meeting because the family is struggling with something that has nothing to do with the patient, that's different. So you really need to understand why you're having a family meeting. I guess my point is, don't forget that we need to have the consent of the patient, because we often treat them as if they no longer have decisions to make, and they do. Well, thank you for your time and have a great day.